It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the new collection from one of America's most famous short story writers.
But first, the Obama administration is proposing a far-reaching overhaul of the NSA's bulk phone records program.
If passed by Congress, the plan would end systematic collection of data about Americans' calling habits, plus the NSA could only get specific records with permission from a judge.
Some privacy advocates have welcomed this reform. Past legislation, though, has been held up because of concerns about national security. Donald Downs joins us now. He's a professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison. Donald, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon.
Well, there's been reluctance in the past, ever since the Snowden leaks let us know that this NSA surveillance was going on. There's been reluctance from the White House, the intelligence community, Congress, to tamper, saying this could interfere with national security needs.
Right.
Do you think that is a real concern?
Well, I think it's a real concern, but it still has to. We're not sure whether or not it would have that kind of effect. There's dispute over whether or not the previous way that NSA was used prevented attacks. Apparently, there hasn't been a whole lot of concrete evidence on that. But if I had to really, stake out a position right now, I would say that the evidence is really unclear to what extent this would be damaging, to what extent it would be helpful for civil liberties. It's not entirely clear. Again, I've been traveling today. I've just read a couple reports about the new administration's proposal. It's not entirely clear what the administration's doing here. And then when you apply that to what's going to come up out of Congress, mm-hmm. what kind of products eventually going to emerge, we're not even clear about that. So right now, I think we're sort of in a state of uncertainty.
Well, yeah, and there are details supposed to come out the next couple of days from President Obama. The basic concept and some of what's coming up before Congress is, hey, NSA, you can't have a server packed with 5 years
right.
of all Americans' phone records.
Right.
They'll be maintained at phone companies for, I think, a year and a half. You want them? Great. With a judge's approval is at least one of the proposals
mm-hmm.
out there.
Right, right.
Is that an improvement, do you think?
Well, it's a change, and it could be an improvement. Let's look at it from the more skeptical side, though. This proposal only applies to email. It doesn't apply to social media, video cameras, the internet, things like that. And if indeed the administration can get really quick access to what the phone companies have, does it really matter whether the government's holding these records or the private companies are? For the most part, the government hasn't used data that's more than 18 months old anyway, even though it can hold it up to 5 years, because they know that the older the stuff is, the less relevant it is or the less important it is for finding people. So it's not entirely clear how big of a change this is, but there is one area that could make a big difference, and right now it's a black box to me. And that is getting to the content of the messages. According to what has been said under the current method, in order to look at the actual content of the phone conversations, they had to get a warrant from the FISA court. Okay, and if indeed they still have to do that, then that's going to sort of continue at least somewhat of a barrier that's been there already. So it really may not change anything. The issue, though, is that the FISA court tends to be very, very compliant to the administration's concerns. Now, one other point here, though, do they, under the new approach, will they need to get judicial approval just to get the phone numbers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and before, they could get the phone numbers automatically. They're right there. And they apply their logarithms to that to see whether or not the phone numbers added up to some sort of suspicious set of phone calls. If they need to get the FISA court to okay getting even the phone numbers, then that is potentially a fairly significant change, depending upon how inconvenient that would be for the administration.
There's also talk of limiting the number of jumps in those phone
right.
number links. So
right
now, I think it's three steps. So
right.
I call our producer. Our producer calls you, Donald
right.
Downs. You call your neighbor.
Right.
They can keep tracking to that neighbor. Under
that's
the new
correct.
System, it's two jumps. It's me
right.
to our producer to you,
right.
and then no further jumps.
Yeah, and I think that's fairly significant because it would put a lot fewer people subject to having their phone numbers looked at quickly and the content looked at quickly. So that could be something that would be important. It doesn't really change the intrinsic power of what the government does it, but it limits its scope.
You mentioned a black box earlier.
Yeah.
Before these Edward Snowden leaks, this was pretty much all a black box, wasn't it? We didn't know what was being done,
right.
how it was being done,
right.
how it was being regulated, anything.
Right. Well, really, there were two types of black boxes. The first one came right after 9/11. Because the Bush administration set up this program without even consulting the full Congress. Now, apparently, members of the intelligence committees understood this, and they kind of gave it the green light until it became public, and they said, oh, my God, we didn't know about it, but that's, you know, Congress covering itself. But so then in 2006, when the New York Times and USA Today exposed what was then the NSA program, they did get authorization, more authorization from Congress, and Congress passed a law that protected the phone companies from being sued. But then, of course, after 2006, the program got even bigger, and that's what we didn't know about the second stage. So that is sort of the second black box that Snowden then exposed.
As we've been tracking this story ever since the Edward Snowden leaks, it seems like a running theme is there are some people, privacy advocates, civil libertarians, who are very upset over the surveillance. Right. A lot of people vaguely unsettled, but maybe not enough to make political action happen. Now we're seeing at least some kind of change from the president. Are people upset about this enough that elements of the government are going to change how they operate?
Well, I that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think the same people that were upset about it before are still upset about it. The reach that Snowden showed has probably made more people concerned about it and somewhat more upset about it. I would look at it from Obama's perspective, maybe concerned about consolidating his base, especially given, you know, political turmoil that he's going through on various fronts right now. So if you're looking for his kind of a political explanation here, that might be what he's trying to do. But I don't really get a sense that the average American is all that concerned. You know, the government, the Fourth Amendment has never applied to phone numbers because those were considered, you call through the telephone to, you know, the phone company, you've sort of surrendered that number to another party. So you've sort of surrendered your expectation of privacy. And that kind of the government's never needed search warrants in order to see what numbers people are calling. The big difference here with the NSA program is how extensive it was, you know, the huge mega data that they were compiling. But then again, in some ways, you know, the more data they have, maybe functionally, de facto, there's relatively more privacy for people because there's so much of it. Our individual phone calls are just buried under this avalanche of other people's phone calls. And the government couldn't look at that stuff until a court gave them the authorization to look at it. They could just look at the phone number. Now, that said, the more the government can trace what we do with our phone numbers, if indeed they're focusing on us, then they can find out a lot more about what we're doing with book, you know, what booksellers we're communicating with, you know, maybe in a psychiatrist's office, you know, things like that. So it's not like they couldn't get at our privacy before, but there was so much of it, we were sort of protected just by the vastness of the program.
It seems like there's this foot race going on between our 18th century document, the Bill of Rights, our 20th century legal system, and this 21st century technology.
Yeah, there's no question. And that's, you know, that's in the history of the Fourth Amendment, having to apply the Fourth Amendment. And a lot of this stuff isn't even Fourth Amendment stuff. It's what the federal government might prohibit by statute. So you have some privacy rights that are given us by Congress's legislation and privacy rights given us by the Fourth Amendment. They're not always the same thing. But there's always been a kind of lag effect in adjusting both statutory and constitutional rights to new technology. And unfortunately, the more pervasive a form of technology gets, the more the court has said we don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy anymore because it's out there in the public realm so much that you just can't expect to have privacy.
Well, we've got these new proposals being unveiled by the White House, some plans, as you mentioned, in Congress. What are the chances of some kind of significant change getting through that divided Congress?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that there's going to be some sort of change, but the big question is going to be whether or not it's significant. Some sources I've looked at, what the Obama administration's come up with today, say it really isn't all that different. It's just a little less scope, and that'll depend on whether or not there's a hurdle the government has to go through even to get the phone numbers. So that's a big unanswered question right now. But if it's made so, you know, depending on the standards that the court will require, it may not be all that much of a change. It just might be more symbolic. And that would be maybe politically advantageous to Congress, right? And Obama, yeah, we've done this thing. Aren't we good guys? But in the same token, maybe they're just going to be perpetuating what they've already got. So the devil's going to be in the details, you know.
Donald Downs, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Donald Downs, professor of political science, law, and journalism at UW-Madison, talking about the president's proposal today to end the NSA's bulk collection of phone call data.
One of Wisconsin Public Radio's most prominent amassers of books, Steve Paulson, joins us now to share some of the best reads that he's come across lately. Steve is the executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he's with us here in studio. Steve, thanks for coming by again.
Oh, it is always a pleasure.
Well, we're going to start out with Lori Moore, maybe the most celebrated short story writer of our time. She used to belong to Wisconsin entirely. She taught at the UW-Madison, but now we have to share her. She's got a new collection out. Can you tell us what she's written?
Yes, it's a collection of short stories called Bark, which is her first collection of short stories in 15 years. So this is a literary event. And as you were saying, Lori Moore was a mainstay of writing here in Wisconsin, taught for many years at the UW, and has since recently moved to Nashville, where she's now teaching, and Vanderbilt. And this is a collection of stories. Most of the stories are dealing with characters kind of in middle age. It's sort of bittersweet relationships, and it has the trademark Lori Moore style. I mean, she has a very distinctive style. Her voice is
witty.
You would recognize it anywhere. Well, it's sort of this. It's this combination of funny and awful. And I mean, that's the thing that's sort of amazing about her. And so she manages to bring humor into anxieties, into misery, and often within the same paragraph or even the same sentence. I mean, that's the thing that I think sort of jumps out at you about her writing.
And you interviewed her recently, right?
I did, yes.
And was she in studio?
She was in studio, yes.
Back in Wisconsin for a while. Well, you brought along a clip for us to listen to from that interview. Do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. So this is reading from the very beginning of the first story in the book. And it's about a guy named Ira who is down on his luck, recently divorced, and he is reflecting on how his life has turned out. So let's listen.
Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Here's what you do for your depression. I'm not going to say lose yourself in charity work. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days and start everything back up again. Bam. I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
That is a great example. Right. And I love how the friend tells him to give up smoking and dairy. Right.
So you don't know whether to laugh or to cry, right, when you hear these stories. And that is what makes Lori Moore such a great writer.
Oh, that's a fabulous one. And anything else you want to say about her, about this collection? That was one of the stories.
Yeah. Well, she even has a ghost story in this collection called Juniper Tree. But it's not really scary. And so there's this person who, this friend of the narrator of the story who has just died but is still kind of hanging around, the dead woman is, and sort of comes back and visits and tells the narrator kind of various ways that she has fallen short in her life. And so for Lori, it's a way of, ghost stories, I think, are sort of, you can explore interesting psychological terrain there.
Did you ask her why she took so long? 15 years. That's a long time between short story collections.
Yeah. Well, she did write a novel a few years ago. So, right. And she's a teacher, and
she's
busy. Busy life.
Yeah. Gotcha. So we're going to move along now to a different kind, a different genre. This is a writer that you say is being hailed as the modern Proust. Who's he?
In some circles, yes. He's a Norwegian writer named Karl Ove Knausgård, and he is involved in this remarkable writing project right now. See, he's come out with a series of books, six in all, which are basically his life story. I mean, it's memoir, except for he bills it as fiction, except for it's extremely autobiographical, and it's warts and all. He is sort of telling everything, the goriest details about his life, about his family's life, and this has been a phenomenon, not just in his native Norway, but throughout Europe. He is being hailed as sort of the hottest thing since, well, since sliced bread or whatever one has in Norway. And apparently it's so popular in Norway, some businesses have said, you know, we need Knausgård-free days, because all anyone wanted to do when a new book of his came out is just to talk about these stories and to rehash them in a way. And do you want a taste of
one? Yeah, so, let's hear what people are so nuts about.
So he is, he sort of has this Scandinavian angst about him. And so this is a passage from his first novel. So one thing I should say is, so the six volumes have come out in Norway and throughout Europe. They're being translated in this country, and two have been published here, and the third is about to come out. So this is a passage from the first volume. He says, "Joy is not my goal, never has been. What good is joy to me? The family is not my goal either. If it had been, and I could have devoted all my energy to it, we would have had a fantastic time, of that I am sure. We could have lived somewhere in Norway, gone skiing and skating in winter with packed lunches and a thermos flask in our backpacks, and boating in the summer, swimming, fishing, camping, holidays abroad with our families. We could have kept the house tidy, spent time making good food, being with our friends. We could have been blissfully happy. That may all sound like a caricature, but every day I see families who successfully organize their lives in this way." And then jumping ahead a bit, he goes on to say, "The question of happiness is banal, but the question that follows is not, the question of meaning. When I look at a beautiful painting, I have tears in my eyes, but not when I look at my children. That does not mean I do not love them, because I do, with all my heart. It simply means that the meaning they produce is not sufficient to fulfill a whole life. Not mine, at any rate. Soon I will be 40. And when I'm 40, it won't be long before I'm 50. And when I'm 50, it won't be long before I'm 60. And when I'm 60, it won't be long before I'm 70. And that will be that. My epitaph might read, 'Here lies a man who grinned and bore it. And in the end, he perished for it.'"
He sounds like a cheery fellow.
Yes.
And this is what's taking Norway and Europe and maybe America by storm.
It is hugely popular and very controversial, as it turns out, for a couple of reasons. One is he is spilling all the nitty-gritty details of his life, his family's life. A lot of these books are about his very troubled relationship with his father, who is stern, a disciplinarian, kind of abusive, and ends up dying an alcoholic. And his father's family was furious when these came out. Apparently, they have stopped talking to him. And then the other reason why it is very controversial is he has called this book My Struggle, Min Kamp, in Norwegian, a play on Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
And, and it's his struggle in his own way. And, I think he was deliberately courting controversy. Now, there's nothing, about nationalism or fascism or anything like that. But he is deliberately being provocative in these stories.
Now, have you made it through volumes one and two?
I have not yet. I'm still working on volume one. But it's kind of curiously addictive, because you have these long passages where he's talking about the most sort of the minutiae of life. I mean, a lot of it is the teenage years. I mean, there's one whole long section where he goes on for pages and pages on how he and a buddy, when they're about 15, they're trying to figure out how to sneak a case of alcohol to a party without his father seeing it. And so you have these kind of passages, and then you have these sort of transcendent passages where he's just sort of reflecting on life. And so it's pretty remarkable.
We'll have to see if it catches on with the American psyche the way it has with the European
and
the Scandinavian. Well, before we run out of time, you've got a third book for us. This is in the realm of science. This one called About Time.
Right, by Adam Frank, who is an astrophysicist. And the reason I thought about this is, there was that news last week of this remarkable discovery that apparently astrophysicists have sort of detected the ripples from the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And Adam Frank is writing about the Big Bang. But the thing to realize about the Big Bang is, it goes back to maybe a millionth or a billionth of a second after the moment of creation. It doesn't actually go back to creation itself. And no one knows what happened back then. Was there just a single universe? Were there multiple universes? So there's this huge controversy about that. And Adam Frank's point is that our theories about cosmology are very much tied into our theories about time. So if you go, for instance, to the Middle Ages, that's when our notion of hours popped up. And then a little bit later, you have Isaac Newton talking about the clockwork universe, as if the universe was like machine parts. And this was right at the time of the Industrial Revolution. And then skip ahead later on to the end of the 19th century. You have, this is the time when the train has suddenly sort of totally transformed our life and our sense of time, because then suddenly what 3:05 meant in New York had to be the same as 3:05 in Philadelphia, because the trains had to...
It really takes you through the sweep of history.
Yes, exactly.
And does it in the end change the way you think about time?
It raises interesting questions. Now we're in the era of the millisecond. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, there's this race to develop the quantum computer, which would totally radically re-engineer our notions of time. So anyway, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Excellent. So lots of three great picks there. Steve, thanks so much for coming by and sharing these with us again.
It's always a pleasure.
We've been talking with executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, also, as you see, a prodigious reader.
A study out last week from the Employment Benefit Research Institute finds that a third of American workers have saved only about $1,000 toward their retirement.
Our guest economist will help us figure out why that is and what it means for our economy. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Do you feel prepared for retirement? Are you struggling to save enough? And if you are in your 20s or your 30s, are you able to set a little money aside for the golden years? Call 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Monique Morrissey joins us now. She's an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Monique, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So in that survey, a third of Americans with only about $1,000 set aside for retirement. Does a number like that surprise you?
Actually, it doesn't surprise me. This has been well known by economists who work on retirement for a while. It depends on what survey you look at, exactly what numbers you get, but most people will find that essentially half of all households have virtually nothing in retirement accounts, and they have a little bit saved in other forms. For example, they have some home equity, but the typical American household really has nothing. And what's more alarming to me, actually, is the fact that even among older households, the amounts are minuscule. So for all intents and purposes, for the majority of Americans, what we think of as the private sector retirement savings and 401ks and that kind of thing is meaningless for the typical household.
Is it as simple as some people have some kind of workplace retirement plan, most likely a 401k, and some people don't, and that's the difference?
Well, that is part of the problem. And this is actually something that's been a problem for forever, but it's just gotten worse. Even at the heyday of traditional pensions, which is something, you know, back in the 70s, a typical person who was covered at work had a more secure defined benefit pension. Even in those days, it was about 45% of the private sector workforce was covered. And now, the sort of people's image of what happened in those days was that the typical worker was male, and then they might be married, and then they had spousal coverage. And so if you took households as a whole, I mean, you did a little bit better than that 45%. Also, public sector workers are more likely to be covered. But nonetheless, it's always been something where about half of the workforce was covered. What has changed in the last 30 years is that the workers that are covered are no longer covered by traditional secure pensions, but they're covered by what I think of as a do-it-yourself retirement plan, which is a 401k. And really what's happening is that people are just really not managing to accumulate much in those plans, in those savings accounts.
Why is that? I mean, you wrote somewhere, I think, that there was a revolution going from pensions to 401ks. Why are people worse off under the 401k system than they would have been under pensions?
Well, first of all, what's interesting is if you look at the overall amounts that are being saved in tax-preferred accounts or savings, so in other words, the amounts that are being set aside supposedly towards retirement, they haven't declined relative to income. What's happening is it's become vastly more unequal. It's also become – the system has also become much riskier for workers. So whereas when in the old days, there was not much difference. Workers who were covered with pensions – usually replace a similar part of their income when they retired. I mean, it's not that, well, high-income workers didn't get more, a bigger pension, but relative to their earnings, it wasn't necessarily that much bigger. And there weren't really big differences between black and white workers, between, you know, so there wasn't any great inequality. And what we've seen, and this is reflecting and actually magnifying what we see in the labor market as a whole, is that we've seen dramatic differences between people in the top quintile, and especially the top 1%, but actually the top 20% of households and everybody else. So it's not that there's not a bunch of money being socked away in these accounts, but for the typical household, it's really not it's not enough to make any difference. To me, my favorite statistic, and it's a depressing one, is that even for households approaching retirement, so age 55 to 64, you have 40% have nothing saved in a retirement account, and then you have another 10% saving who have about $12,000, which is really not anything, really. And this is people approaching retirement. And then, you know, if you look at the top 20%, they have significant amount of money. So really, we've seen this dramatic increase in inequality. And what's more, people are also facing a lot more risk. Even those who have something set aside, the amounts that they have saved or what they can look forward to in retirement is a lot more insecure.
And we saw in 2008 with the economic crisis, a lot of people who had calculated their retirement date based on a 401k, other things that had stocks in it, found themselves having to delay that retirement as the market dropped. Right?
Yes, exactly. I know it was calamitous. In fact, until that happened, most people thought the baby boomers were doing okay, not because they weren't affected by some of the changes in the retirement landscape. In addition to the shift from secure pensions to 401k plans, the other thing we've seen that happened in the last 30 years has been a gradual cut in Social Security benefits. A lot of people are not aware of that, but benefits have been cut by about a quarter since 1983, mostly in the form of an increase in the retirement age, which is a bit of a misnomer. Economists think of it as simply as a cut in the benefit. But in any case, this is taking place gradually. Despite that, the baby boomers, a lot of them were covered by pensions at some point in their working lives. They also saw the run-ups in housing markets and stock markets, and people thought they were doing okay, not great, but okay. And then then there was a 2008 downturn, and it sort of laid bare how poorly even the baby boomers were doing. And generations after the baby boomers are projected to do much worse. So the baby boomers were sort of the peak, and they weren't doing very well. And then everything since then is for younger generations is even worse.
Then as we're saving less, we're good news, living longer. Bad news, have to pay to live longer with less money.
Yes, no. And that's actually one of the things that's interesting. It's a good news, bad news story, as you point out. It's good that we're living longer. People are also working longer. We have a tendency to beat up on ourselves in this country, I think, and think, oh, everybody's lazy and shiftless. But really, if you're a retirement economist, what you can't help noticing is that there's been this dramatic increase in how long and how much people work. So there was also you start off with a big increase in the women's labor force participation, and then also in labor force participation of older workers. So we're actually working a lot more than we used to before we retire. And, you know, both trends should help us in retirement. Women used to have to rely the typical work trajectory for women was they were in and out of the workforce as they raised kids, and they had to rely heavily on their husband's benefits for retirement, and that didn't necessarily help them if they, weren't, married or if they got divorced. But nonetheless, as women have started working more and working longer, especially mothers, that's helped a little bit. And then also, basically, people are not retiring. The labor force participation rate of 65 and over group is higher than it has been in half a century. And that's about as far as you can go, in terms of statistics, which is really pretty striking.
Let's go to our callers now at 608. No, what am I talking about? What's our number? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Melissa on the line in Madison. Melissa, hi there.
Hi, yeah, thank you for taking my call. It's just very interesting listening to the program. I'm 28 years old. I basically live paycheck to paycheck, but one thing that my parents and my grandparents instilled in me very young was the importance of saving for retirement. I do want to retire, and I want to enjoy that time of my life. So while I don't have a lot of extra spending money, I know that there is money being put away in my 401k, and I don't even see it. I don't pay attention to it. And a lot of my other friends don't do it. And to me, especially if you have a program where employer matches, that's free money. So I'm 28 years old. I've been in my current job for 7 years, and I have about $20,000 there. And I pretend that the money is not there. And I look forward to using it and not working forever. And I always try to stress that with my friends, and I wish more people my age would see that.
Melissa, thanks a lot for the call. Monique, do you think that's a fairly unique story?
It's not unique, but it is unusual, and I want to commend Melissa for saving. And she's right. I mean, not only the earlier you save, the better, because, you know, people talk about how your earnings accumulate. But also, weirdly, we have a very strange system for subsidizing retirement that depends on the earnings on your investments. And the earlier you put money away, the more you get a tax benefit. Also, you get the employer match if your employer provides a match. That said, I don't like to point to other people. I mean, I don't know about Melissa's other friends, but there are a lot of young people who are unemployed or barely employed, and also many, many whom have student debts or other debts. And it's really important people pay off their debts before. I mean, it's good to save, but it's understandable that a lot of people are not saving. And in general, that's also a big problem that we've seen. It's not just for the youngest, for the millennials, but is that what's happened at the same time that we've seen a big increase in inequality overall in the labor market and in retirement, what happened to the typical household and the typical worker is that basically wages have stagnated. And for younger workers, because of the Great Recession, a lot of them have had trouble entering into the workforce or getting good, decent jobs where you can set some money aside. But even before that happened, it's one of the things that happened is, you know, previous generations until, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, people sort of counted on earning a little bit more and setting aside the difference. And when people stopped, you know, the typical worker stopped making more, they actually wages stagnated for half of the workforce. It got harder and harder to set anything aside. So it's not that unusual. And it's that, and also, you know, student debt is a big problem.
We're talking to Monique Morrissey of the Economic Policy Institute about retirement insecurity in the United States, inspired in part by a new study finding that one in three American workers have only about $1,000 saved up for retirement.
You can join the show. Do you have a 401k plan at your work, or did you have a pension? Do you wish you had something like that? And what's stopping you from saving for retirement? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation with economist Monique Morrissey about retirement after a recent study found many Americans aren't saving much for life after work.
You can join in. Are you in that boat? Why don't you or why can't you set aside money for retirement? Are you worried? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right back to our callers now with Sue in Superior. Sue, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm in my late 30s. My husband's in his early 40s. And I ended up cashing in my retirement because of car issues and needing just house repairs, different things like that. And it, I guess every time I end up saving money, it ends up going towards some kind of big problem that arises in life. And
all right, Sue. And that's probably not a unique situation. Again, Monique, a lot of people dealing with debt, and that may take priority over retirement savings.
Yes, no, absolutely. And, you know, it's fairly typical of retirement experts to tisk about that, you know, oh, you shouldn't touch it, you should never touch it. But it's not really realistic. If people are hit with big medical expenses, loss of a job, things like that, and also what happens is if people already owe money, it's better, you know, you're better off paying off your credit card first. You know, you don't want to keep a credit card account balance. You can borrow from many 401k accounts at a better rate than what you're paying for your credit card. All of these things, I mean, again, not ideal, but realistic for many people and very common. And what is a mistake, though, I would say, is just to casually cash out what you've saved up when you switch jobs. That happens too often and for the wrong reasons. Like, it's one thing to do it if you really, really need it and you have few options. It's another thing, a lot of people, when they switch jobs, they sort of just take advantage of it. They think, oh, well, I got $10,000 or $20,000. It's not really much, so I might as well just cash it out. Now, that's a mistake, because that $10,000 or $20,000, if you're young enough, will accumulate to something, you know, something meaningful when you retire, and you don't want to just keep tapping it casually.
Sue, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. We'll go to Nick in Milwaukee now. Nick, hi.
Hi. I'm 29 years old. I was considering going the IRA route, but just recently I read an article in the AARP about the MyRA that the Obama administration is starting later this year. I was wondering if you had any more information about that.
Thanks for the call, Monique. We don't need to go too far to financial counseling here, but are you familiar with the MyRA concept?
Yes, the MyRA is it's a good sort of starter plan. What it does is it invests your money in a fund of government bonds, and so therefore it's very safe. It's quite conservative, and it also I've had some issues with it because once your account reaches $15,000, then it rolls over into an IRA, and so I have also issues with IRAs. A lot of IRAs are high fee, and a lot of the investments are not very appropriate. So you can kind of go from being ultra-conservative and being thrown into something that may actually be the opposite of ultra-conservative, but quite expensive and risky if you're not careful. Either way, if you're looking at an IRA or a MIRA that will end up being rolled over to an IRA, you should look very carefully at fees. A lot of people think, oh, well, the fees don't matter that much. They seem very small. It's often, you know, the fees that you're paying are a little bit hidden, and they might look like, if you're looking at comparing mutual funds, you know, it might look like a few, like 75 basis points or something, which is 0.75 percentage points. It doesn't look like very much, but that can eat away at what you save a lot over time. So I encourage everybody to scrutinize what they have, and not just in an IRA, but in a 401k, and try to base their investment decisions a lot on the fees that they're paying, and also balancing things, not having, you know, not a lot of individual savers tend to have either ultra-conservative or ultra-risky portfolios, and it's better to be somewhere, balance it more evenly between bonds and stocks, for example. But mainly, if you have access to passive investments like index funds that are very low cost, look carefully at those. I'm not an investment advisor, but I think that that's pretty standard advice. I don't think you can't go that far wrong doing that.
Well, that reminds me, a lot of the commentary when a study comes along that says we're not saving enough for retirement, as long as the personal finance lines we're improvident, we're not planning for the future, it's an individual problem. Do you think we focus too much on that and not enough on some of the more baseline structural issues?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. 401ks are an accident of history. They were created in 1980 by a benefit consultant who was working on deferred compensation for bankers. This was not designed for regular workers. And if that sounds condescending, I don't mean it to you, because I'm an economist who focuses on retirement, and I do not follow, I don't follow my own advice. I mean, I'm not terrible, but I don't do what you're supposed to do, which is rebalance. And I don't have, I actually literally split 50-50 bond and stocks, which is, again, not too smart, not the worst, but not too smart. If even people like, I don't know how to look up some of the buried fees that, that are very, very hard to find. It was something that was really not designed for workers. It was designed for people who were going to get something on top of a traditional pension, sort of that they could play around with, extra, like a bonus, not what somebody should retire on. And I think that it pains me when a lot of times the conversation is about how do we get people to save more and how do we get people to be more financially literate. But I just don't think we're ever going to get a situation where the typical person wants to be their own financial advisor. What we need to do is get a situation where people, even with human people, real human beings, aren't paying high fees that they can't see, aren't investing very riskily or extremely conservatively because they just don't know any better, where we should have default investments. In fact, ideally, people shouldn't have to make investment choices at all, that are appropriate, and that we should really do something about the fact that a lot of the fees are inappropriately high. So I think that the system is really not set up for people. In addition to that, the system is geared to do pretty well by high income people who can take advantage of employer matches, who take better advantage of the tax subsidy. If you are a low earner, you actually get little or no tax benefit from saving in these things. I mean, it's really upside down. It works, very well for the top 20% who want to do this, but that's, it doesn't work well at all for the middle class and for low income people. So I don't think we should be blaming the victims here.
Go back to the phones now with Kurt in Island Lake. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm going to be 65 this year. I retired at 62 and a half, and my spouse is looking at retirement maybe this year or next year. And I sit back and I look, we are married, we have three children, they're all working adults. And I look back on the decisions that we had to make early on in the process of raising three children. The first car we bought certainly wasn't new. The first house was a fixer-upper. And I look at the pressure that is on the people today with their student loans and the commitments that they make. And we tried to emphasize to our children that, as this lady was saying, you know, you start early and you build. My concern is, and I think a lot of people in my generation turn around and look back at some of the youth today and say, they want it all now. Where we have a tendency to look back at ourselves and say, we earned it along the way. And along with that was a lot of sacrifices, not just raising three kids. I am concerned about one statistic that I heard, and perhaps the lady can verify this. I heard that between 55 and 60-year-old people, the average amount of money saved for retirement is only about $18,000.
Kurt, thanks a lot for the call. Briefly, Monique, a lot of people you mentioned earlier don't have a lot of money. Just briefly, what's the economic impact of all those people retiring and not having the money to pay for it?
Well, what's happening is a lot of people are not retiring, and so there's a lot of long-term unemployment among older workers. But that's just, the problem is, as you can figure out, a lot of people don't have that choice. They lose their jobs, they can't get another one, and it's basically poverty. It's hardship. I was talking to somebody recently who was describing this new phenomenon of older workers who go live for free in state parks to help out there, and they sort of volunteer or casual jobs. People living in Walmart parking lots. You know, I mean, so there's like a lot. I mean, there are people who are genuinely poor. There have always been that group of people, but there are also a lot of people who are, I don't think, ever thought they were going to live this very marginal existence.
All right, we'll need to leave it there. Thanks to Monique Morrissey for joining us, economist at the Economic Policy Institute, talking about limited retirement savings in the United States.